From the salons of Victorian Britain to the gates of Auschwitz, this is the story of an idea which runs through some of the worst atrocities of the 20th century, an idea that echoes through the decades and resonates today. This is the story of eugenics, its dark history and its troubling present.
Bring you some breaking news now. The United States Supreme Court has overturned Roe v. Wade.
We're outside the Supreme Court after the landmark decision that ended a woman's constitutional right to an abortion.
As they hear the news from the court, there's jubilation from anti-abortionists.
Life wins the day! Life wins the day!
Demonstrators, both for and against the court's decision, were quick to react here in Washington and across the country.
Eugenics was a movement to breed better humans, in the same way you might breed faster racehorses or woollier sheep. But that depends on making sure some people breed and others don't. If you want to win horse races, you can't let the slow ones breed. These are all questions of control, and in this case, birth control. In 2019, Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas outlined a potted history of eugenics in America as part of a formal legal report. In it, he claims that the fundamental case for abortion was shaped by the eugenics movement. Others disagreed, claiming that interfering in a woman's right to choose is the more eugenic policy. Well, this episode is about the eugenic campaign to control birth that took place in America across the 20th century. Who should have children? Who should be prevented from having children? And who gets to make those decisions? In the last episode, we traced the triumph of the nativist anti-immigration movement in America. But for the eugenicists, there was also a threat from within. The so-called degenerates and deviants, those deemed feeble-minded or promiscuous, all popping out babies faster than the ruling classes and filling the nation with bad genetic stock. You can't close the borders to those already inside, so how else could they control reproduction across the country?
The first place in the world to introduce a eugenic sterilization law was Indiana.
This is Professor Alexandra Minna-Stern from UCLA's Institute for Society and Genetics.
So Indiana's law, which was passed in 1907, it first targeted poor white people, particularly men who were seen as deviant in sexual and behavioral terms. It was followed by Washington State 2 years later. And later in 1909, California passed the third sterilization law in the country.
Sterilization. In women, it's tubal ligation, the severing of the fallopian tubes. In men, it's by vasectomy. It's a bitter irony that America, a nation proudly and foundationally associated with personal freedom and liberty of the individual, was the first in the world to enshrine such an intimate violation into law. Here's a line from a pamphlet from 1909 entitled The Sterilization of Degenerates by one H.C. Sharp, an American physician and vasectomy enthusiast at the Indiana Reformatory.
Since October 1899, I have been performing an operation known as vasectomy. This operation is indeed very simple and easy to perform. I do it without administering an anesthetic, either general or local. It requires about 3 minutes' time to perform the operation, and the subject returns to his work immediately, suffers no inconvenience, and is in no way impaired for his pursuit of life, liberty, and happiness, but is effectively sterilized.
Winston Churchill had read Sharp's pamphlet in 1910. We know he was excited by it because he underlined long passages in thick blue pencil. And he wrote to Home Office officials asking them to explore the practicalities of something like the Indiana law in Britain. But it never came to pass. Despite Churchill's political will, Britain did not get sterilisation onto its books. With men like Sharp holding the knife, Indiana's sterilisation laws were galloping into action, and other states would follow soon after. America outperformed Britain's eugenic movement and was building momentum. But there's another cultural revolution taking place in the jazz age, one that also poses a threat to the status quo, the emancipation of women.
Beginning in the 1890s, a new generation of women have greater opportunities than ever before to attend college and choose college and career over marriage and motherhood.
This is Wendy Klein, professor of the history of medicine at Purdue University.
So much so that by 1920, women accounted for nearly 50% of the university population, which I think is fairly remarkable. And for many, triggered fears about what was going to happen to the domestic sphere.
Not only are women becoming more educated, but genteel Victorian values are being eroded. This is Prohibition era, but booze and dancing and jazz and sex is everywhere.
What does anybody know about women in the 1920s? The first thing that comes into anyone's mind is the flappers, right? So they're showing more skin, they're drinking, they're dancing. They appear as, you know, sexual objects in a way that their forebears did not. All you have to do is look at fashion trends between 1890 and 1920, and you see layers of clothing being removed. You see the what historians call the commodification of leisure, that instead of, you know, strolling through Central Park, you're going to go to dance halls, you're going to go to Coney Island, you're going to go to movie theaters, and you're going to engage with the opposite sex in ways that a previous generation simply couldn't. And then once that becomes the standard, obviously you need to start thinking about birth control. And we know they did, because we know that fertility rates are going down.
People were thinking about birth control, and some were even using it, but they were rarely talking about it. At this time, contraception is effectively illegal under a mix of federal and state legislation collectively known as the Comstock Laws. But as a topic for political or personal discussion, it is utterly taboo.
In the early 20th century, it was almost more controversial to talk about birth control than it was to talk about eugenics or sterilization. And that's a really troubling thing for people today to comprehend. And that has a lot to do with that one word, control.
The eugenicists wanted to control who was using contraception, but they were split. For some, the case for access to birth control was also, in part, deeply humane, a moral cause.
Tonight, we go after the story of the woman who violated convention and bucked powerful opposition to lead the birth control movement in America. You see her behind me. She's Mrs. Margaret Sanger, who was thrown into jail 8 different times for her efforts.
Margaret Sanger being introduced on American TV in 1957. Sanger's passion for supplying women with birth control came from her work as a nurse, where she'd observed terrible cases of women suffering and even dying from botched abortions. Sanger's own mother had 11 children and died young. And she encountered many women living in desperate conditions, burdened with more children than they wanted or could properly support. That's why she was so deeply committed to the idea that contraception was necessary for women to have true freedom.
No woman can call herself free who does not own and control her body. No woman can call herself free until she can choose consciously whether she will or will not be a mother.
Her campaign was ferocious and determined. On October the 16th, 1916, she opened the first ever family planning and birth control clinic in Brooklyn. It was illegal. She was arrested and the clinic forced to close down 9 days later. But ultimately, she founded the organization that would become Planned Parenthood, which to this day provides reproductive health care to women across America. She is rightly regarded as a feminist icon to many. But Margaret Sanger was also a eugenicist.
Well, I think the greatest sin in the world is bringing children into the world that have disease from their parents, that have no chance in the world to be a human being, practically. Delinquents, prisoners, all sorts of things, just marked when they're born. That, to me, is the greatest sin that people can commit.
Yes, Sanger was fighting for women to have control, but she also thought that poor people should have fewer children and that those with certain supposedly inherited defects should have no children at all. In May 1919, the slogan on the cover of her journal, Birth Control Review, read, "More children for the fit, less for the unfit." But other eugenicists, mostly the men, were in stark opposition to her views on contraception. Charles Davenport, for instance, was vociferously opposed. Fertility among white middle-class women was in decline, and contraception was partly to blame.
A lot of the mainline eugenicists were against it because of that issue of control, because they recognize that the people most likely to use birth control were exactly the ones they were hoping would not use it.
Declining fertility rates amongst these increasingly educated and sexually liberated white middle-class women? This is dangerous. The response? Well, the eugenicists begin campaigning for a return to old-fashioned values, to the traditional role of women in families, motherhood and reproductive morality, a duty of women to reproduce and raise a eugenically fit family as a contribution to the nation's racial health. And how better to engage the people with such traditional values? Make it a competition. And thus, the Fitter Families contests were born. We're at the Kansas Free Fair in Topeka, 1920, a state celebration of agriculture and local business and all the fun of the fair. There's horse racing and car shows. Farmers compete for the hugest pumpkin, the fattest pig, and the speediest horses. But the breeding competitions are not limited to livestock, because there's the Eugenic and Health Building, a one-story wooden cottage adorned with displays and posters declaring that careful breeding could eliminate unfit human traits within three generations. Here at the fair, the organisers of the Fitter Family competitions are Dr. Florence Brown Sherbin, a child welfare officer from Kansas, and one Mary T. Watts of the Iowa Parent Teacher Association.
We use the word eugenics as a sign over the door of the building at the Kansas Fair where we test human stock, and it causes considerable discussion. When someone asks what it is all about, we say, well, while the stock judges are testing the Holsteins, Jerseys and White Faces in the stock pavilion, we are testing the Joneses, the Smiths and the Johnsons, and nearly everyone replies, I think it is about time people had a little of the attention that is given to animals.
Kansas in 1920 was 97% white. These Hoosiers, as Indianans call themselves, came in their droves to give up blood and urine samples, to have themselves weighed and measured. They took IQ tests and answered a battery of questions about their daily habits, their medical and family histories, their pedigrees. And when the judging is all done, each family member receives a grade. Anyone scoring a B+ was given a bronze medal bearing the quotation from Psalms, "Yea, I have a goodly heritage." And the grade A's get medals too, with the inscription, "Presented by Arthur Kappa, Kansas Senator, for excellent eugenic showing."
The coveted gold medal goes to the Johnsons.
And so the idea spreads. Eugenics is a pursuit being nurtured in the worried white middle classes and the working classes too, especially in farming communities. This mainstream adoption of eugenic ideas is evident in the way it penetrated everyday consumer culture. There's eugenic facial cream being advertised in the dailies and Eugenicol, a new scientific brand of shampoo and hair tonic. Here's Wendy Klein again.
I mean, just think about the names Eugene and Eugenia. Obviously, they both mean well-born, and they were suddenly extremely popular in the 1920s and 30s. And I can't think of a better way to kind of suggest the ways in which eugenics has moved into popular culture than actually naming your child after it.
In the jazz age, the concept has become mainstream culture, consumer culture, a means to a healthy and attractive family life, with a sheen of scientific-sounding legitimacy, as well as the moral association of preserving the vigour and health of your nation or your race. Now we jump forward to the 1960s, North Carolina. By this point, the horror of Nazi atrocities had been exposed. You might think then that eugenics had been unmasked as a poisonous ideology. But eugenic sterilization was still the law in many US states, and eugenic ideas were still very much in play. In fact, there are people alive today who were sterilized under these laws. We spoke to one extraordinary woman called Elaine Riddick. Today, Elaine campaigns to document the awful harm that was inflicted on her and others in the name of eugenics. Now, I must warn you that what follows is distressing. It includes experiences of sexual violence and trauma. But the testimony of those who suffered under eugenic policies is a vital part of this history. This is Elaine's story.
I was raised in an urban town, Ocala, Windfall, North Carolina. It was very rural. We were very poor people. So, of course, we had to go into the fields. And during this time, you know, normally there's a requirement for education. But if you had to go in the fields and work, you know, you had to be in the fields. The farmers needed their work done. And, you know, they would come like at 6 o'clock in the morning in a big truck or a pickup truck. And all the people in the community would get on the back of the packed in the truck to go and be field hands. Pick cotton or tobacco, peanuts or whatever it was for that season or that time of year.
Then in 1968, when Elaine was just a teenager and living with her grandmother, her life was changed forever.
On a Sunday afternoon, we normally go and shoot pool or, you know, all the children in the neighborhood get together and, you know, do something, but you got to be home at a certain time. So anyway, I was on my way home and the man jumps out the bush from behind a built-in and he grabbed me and drugged me to a car. And there where he raped me, you know, and then he threatened that if I ever told anyone that he was going to kill me. And he was 6'1 or 6'2, you know, and I was just a baby, you know. So what happened is that I got pregnant. The social worker found out. People were talking like I was gaining weight, you know. And back then, you know, in this rural community, you know, we wasn't taught about sex. And we wasn't taught about babies or, you know, even I didn't know, you know, what was going on with my body because nobody discussed this with us. So I'm dumbfounded.
At this point, the state machinery of eugenics started to take over. As a poor, black, pregnant teenager from a troubled family, Elaine was exactly the kind of person targeted by the authorities.
So 9 months later or 8 months later, I had my son. My grandmother, I don't believe, have gotten out the first grade, so she didn't understand what she was signing. She couldn't even sign her name, so they had her to sign an X on the paper. So my grandmother signed an X because, again, she was coerced. If you don't do this to her, what we're going to do is we're going to stop your food supplements. So when I went into the hospital to have my son, what they did, they took my son out, and while they had me open up, they sterilized me.
Guided by the assessment of the social worker, the Eugenics Board of North Carolina had determined that Elaine should be sterilized after giving birth by cesarean section in 1968. She wasn't even told. Several years later, after getting married and trying for more kids, Elaine learned what had happened, informed by a doctor after a medical examination. Many, many years of struggle followed. In 1974, the American Civil Liberties Union filed a lawsuit on her behalf, alleging she'd been unlawfully deprived of the right to bear children. The case dragged on and was eventually decided against her in 1983. Elaine appealed the case to the Supreme Court, but they declined to even hear it. In 2002, with help from the historian Joanna Schoen and others, the buried institutional records relating to Elaine's case and those of thousands more came to light. And the campaign for recognition and recompense suddenly gained a new momentum.
And from there, everything just broke loose. Because then I thought that I was the only person that this had happened to. And then I found out that it happened to another person. And gradually, I find out that it happened to 7,600 people. 299 of those people were under the age of 18.
The North Carolina governor established a task force to investigate what had happened to these thousands of people. For Elaine, that meant more meetings, more public hearings. Throughout the fight for recognition and recompense, Elaine's son, Tony, was by her side.
I was with her when she went to court every day in New Bern, North Carolina. And I actually heard doctors and witnesses admit that they were wrong. I mean, these were people who were living that were involved with the eugenics movement or the sterilization process in the state of North Carolina. They admitted that they were wrong and they shouldn't have done it. This is what they admitted to.
Eventually, in 2012, a compensation program was announced and a formal apology was issued. A small amount of money, around $50,000, was paid to Elaine and other survivors. It was not exactly justice, but it was the end of one chapter.
The first thing to understand about the eugenics in North Carolina is that it consisted of five white men that sit there around a table and decided on who should be able to give birth and who shouldn't. So what happened is when the social worker sent my papers to them, they had never even spoke to me, and they declared me as being feeble-minded. And I just couldn't believe it. I'm not feeble-minded. And so I set out, when I found that part out, this is how I got here. Because I made up my mind. I was going to work and I was going to show them that I was never feeble-minded. I went to New York City Tech, where I acquired my associate degree in human services.
The basis for eugenic sterilization was the idea that they could accurately diagnose people who were so-called feeble-minded, and because it was genetic, that the children of those people were also likely to be feeble-minded too. They were wrong.
Now, they sterilized her under the assumption that my mother would produce feeble-minded offspring. This is what they said. Well, my mother wasn't feeble-minded based on their own test scores and so forth and so on. Obviously, I'm not feeble-minded. I excelled in high school academically and athletically. I excelled on a university level academically. I excelled on a corporate level working in research and development for IBM. I excelled. So every area that the eugenics program said that we would fail at, we have excelled. What does that mean? That means that the eugenics program in and of itself is flawed. It was flawed from the very inception.
Now, Elaine is dedicated to campaigning on behalf of other vulnerable women and children.
The Rebecca Project for Justice is a transformational organization that advocates for the dignity and freedom for human life in America and around the world. I didn't have no one to protect me when I was a little kid and coming up, and I want to make sure that these children have a goal of life. I want to give them hope, and I want to make sure that they're able to go out into society where they can become productive human beings.
Elaine has managed to use her own traumatic experience to help others. But her experience resonates with many thousands of other women and girls who were targeted by eugenics policies.
There are so many aspects of Elaine's story that resonate with the longer history of eugenics. So first, the fact that she was labeled feeble-minded, which takes us all the way back to the first stirrings of eugenics programs and sterilization programs in the country. Next, that she was 15 years old. I mean, so many teenagers, particularly young girls, were sterilized at the hands of state authorities. In addition, the fact that she was raped. So you have this kind of blame the victim mentality, where many of the young girls who were deemed promiscuous or deviant were actually had been subjected to sexual abuse at the hands of, you know, family members or neighbors.
When sterilization programs first began in 1907, poor white people, predominantly men, were the targets. But by the 1950s and 60s, the majority of people being sterilized were women of color. Many, many thousands of people would be sterilized under these laws. We still don't really know the true numbers.
There are about 60,000 recorded sterilizations. And that, I underscore the word recorded, because that's most definitely an undercount. That's what made it into the reports of various institutions and are in the documentation. But we know that sterilizations occurred both in institutions where it wasn't necessarily legally allowed, and also among private physicians who, you know, were card-carrying eugenicists, let's say.
Stories like Elaine's remind us that this is not just history. Her life and the lives of thousands of others were changed irreversibly by these policies of the state exerting absolute control over their bodies. 31 states had enforced sterilization on their books and kept them there for the majority of the 20th century. California repealed those laws in 1979, Oregon in 1986. But don't think that this means the practice has gone away. In 2020, there were reports that up to 20 women had undergone involuntary sterilization in Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, detention centers. Eugenics was always about control over who gets to make reproductive choices. Justice Clarence Thomas argued that abortion is a potential tool of eugenics. And he wasn't wrong. Birth control was embraced by some eugenicists. Thomas supported the decision to overturn Roe v. Wade and remove the constitutional right to abortion. Now, abortion access is up to individual states. But the question was, and is, who gets to choose? Is it the state, medical institutions, or individuals? The battle for control has shifted, but it rages on. In the next episode of Bad Blood, we follow the path of eugenics from Britain to America to Germany, and ultimately to the gates of Auschwitz.